Welcome to the weekly podcast from the Church of England. In this week's programme, we hear from the Bishop of Salisbury, Nicholas Holtham, on the importance of engaging in climate change conversations. But first, the Reverend Canon Professor Richard Burridge, who is Dean of King's College London and Professor of Biblical Interpretation, talks about the annual Deering Memorial Lecture, which he delivered this week, looking at the role and calling of faith-based institutions in higher education.
Lord Deering was the consummate civil servant, served for various decades for the National Coal Board, and then came in and did a number of sequence of reports on various aspects of education. I've been a member of the General Synod representing the University of London for some 20 years, and I remember Lord Deering speaking to us in the Synod about church schools. But the primary Deering report about higher education in 1997, Higher Education in the Context of the Learning Society, in many ways sets the tracks for the whole university system for the last 25 years.
And can you tell me more about the Cathedrals Group and who is in it?
The Cathedrals Group is an umbrella term for what were originally the church-founded teacher training colleges. During the 1830s and 40s and 50s, following the foundation of King's College London, there was an outpouring of founding of teacher training colleges to train teachers to teach primary aged school children who otherwise would have been in child labour, decades before universal primary education became available. And it wasn't just Anglicans, it was also Catholics and Methodists. And these became the church teacher training colleges, the colleges of higher education, which when the polytechnics became universities in the early 1990s, were, as it were, the third rung. And many of them have been merging over the last decade and have all become church-founded universities in their own right. They were founded primarily to provide church-based teacher training. They continue to have education as an absolutely key part of their work, but also many other vocations. Some of them have a big area in things like nursing and so on, for instance, as well. And they provide a really important service within our higher education service. They're much more regional based. Very often they're mergers, so that, for instance, there's Liverpool Hope, which was a merger of the Anglican and the Roman Catholic. The University of Roehampton now, which was actually a merger of Anglican, Roman Catholic, Methodist, and a secular institution. And Ripon York, St John, Christchurch, Canterbury, College of Mark and St John, Plymouth, Chichester, Winchester, all across the country. These institutions are facing significant challenges in modern society because of the rise of pluralism, multiculturalism, and of course the atheistic challenge under people like Richard Dawkins. And there seems to be often a coyness or even an embarrassment around about admitting that one has an Anglican or a faith heritage. So one of the challenges for them is actually how do you build upon your church-based originally when you want it to be something significant and something different, but to do it in a way when often religion is seen as a negative factor today, to do it in a way that's attractive for particularly for young people.
How are market forces affecting higher education today?
This summer I was on holiday in Athens. And I love going to Athens, particularly visiting the ancient Agora, where St. Paul preached and where Socrates went round debating. And I always find it very interesting that the Agora was placed between the temples on the Acropolis and Plato's Academy. And the idea was that actually religion and faith and academia should challenge and debate in the Agora with the worlds of business and politics. For us these days, I think business and politics have taken over the academy, and threatening to take over the churches as well, for that matter. Education generally, and higher education in particular, has been chronically underfunded by successive governments now for decades. And the whole point about Lord Deering's report in 1997 was that we couldn't go on trying to expand world-class universities with such appallingly poor funding. Lord Deering himself was talking about it in terms of a graduate contribution, perhaps even a graduate tax, and suggesting that graduates who earn more salary because of their university education should pay more tax, and that seemed eminently fair. And what actually happened in the end, of course, was the introduction of what we now know as student fees, first of 1,000, then of 3,000, now of 9,000, and in getting even more. So that my children, who are recent graduates, are going on with debts of tens of thousands of pounds. And this has completely affected the way universities function, so the student is the primary customer, putting themselves into debt to buy our product, which they will then earn back with their pay in due course. And that changes the very nature of universities as a place of repository of values, the search for truth, and the transmission of our culture. The Cathedral Group universities with their church foundations are uniquely placed because they are required by their charter and their foundation to look at the Christian faith as at the core of their values that they operate on. And it seems to me that the Christian faith talks a lot about the worth of every individual, the fact that God thinks being a human being is such an important thing that he's even prepared to do it himself in the person of Jesus of Nazareth, that he loves us so much that he dies for us on the cross. These are extraordinary values that would transform higher education away from being purely a commercial transaction. Some of the church-based cathedral group universities are clearer about those sorts of values than others. And one of the things I'm trying to do in my lecture is to challenge them to have the courage to be a distinctive voice for the Christian faith in the world of higher education. It remains true that you cannot understand Britain, British values, British culture and so on without some understanding of all of its Christian roots. Around 60% of people identified in the last census as Christian. A further 10%, an increasing numbers, were identifying themselves as Muslim and other major world faiths. My experience here at King's College London is actually it's my Jewish and my Muslim students and colleagues want us to take our Christian faith seriously. They want to know that we pray just as they pray. They want to know that we fast in Lent because, well, they fast in Ramadan. And in that way, they want to see us taking our faith seriously. Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's a professor also here at Kingston, he stepped down from being chief rabbi, and we're very proud to have him as an alumnus of the college, talked very strongly in his most recent book about the importance of Jews being Jews, Muslims being Muslims, Christians being Christians, and together as the children of Abraham, trying to stand up to some of the forces that want to tear our world apart. So I don't see any conflict here between wanting to promote Christian values on the one hand, which I do, and on the other, caring for all of our staff and students from all beliefs and backgrounds.
You may remember from last week's podcast that we spoke to the Reverend Bill Blakey about the remembrance services held in Bryce Norton. This week, he spoke to us about how a grant from the Military Community Covenant is helping to integrate armed forces personnel and the community at St John the Evangelist in Carterton.
The Military Covenant grant money is something that has to be done through the civic authorities, and the main broker is the County Council, because Oxfordshire County Council was one of the first counties to sign up to the Military Covenant in this way, although now the Church of England has indeed done that. I was present earlier this year at Lambeth when the Archbishops and government ministers signed a covenant, but that doesn't have the same monetary value in that sense. We were one of the first churches to take up money through an application to the Military Covenant grant scheme, because over the years, we've been increasingly integrating what we and the padres on the base do together. The RAF authorities shut the church on the base, and we here at St John's now really serve as the station church. Now, we at St John's here really serve as the station church, and people from the base worship. And when they're in church, it's maybe Malcolm or Craig or whatever, as opposed to, say, station commander or junior rank. That's really quite important, and they rub along with other members of the church who live here and have perhaps lived here a long time, or another segment of the population of people who've retired from the RAF or Army, having served here at RAF Bryce Norton. And as someone put it, well, all of us here are genuinely on a level, whether we're serving, retired, or civilian. And, you know, so a junior rank could call the station commander Malcolm, for example, if they so choose, here, but sir, every other time. And one young man put it this way, he said, I prefer to come to a church outside the wire, because there I feel as if I'm off duty and can worship more freely. Which I thought was a lovely little testimony of the fact that we're working together. We also offer offer facilities for families, for example, a drop-in, and Messy Church is something that's proving popular with families. And one of the nice things is that, in a way, we don't know whether someone is a Forces family or not, although actually we do, but it's irrelevant. We're just people working together and worshipping and praying and reaching out to each other. Carterton's a new community. The church there was not a community until about 1900, and the first church was built in 1905. The current one dates from 1963, with a major doubling in 1993, and we've got a long job in continuing to build a church here. And the military covenant enabled us to put in new corridors and doors to make the access better, particularly for the disabled. A member of the district council's son is quite significantly disabled, and he trialled it, and there are pictures on our website of Alistair going up the ramps, feeling very pleased that there's level access. It also has meant that the building can be used more flexibly, so we could have guides in one part and a meeting in another, and so on. And also, they've been good enough to, because they chose what to spend the money on. We offered them a menu of alternatives, and they chose, and the doors and the access was one, and the other was a fire alarm system, which, because we've got a commercial kitchen, they felt it was right to help us with that. So the whole thing is geared towards looking after families and older people, everyone. So, for example, if an RAF family has a baptism, they use the hall often for perhaps a reception afterwards and such like. So, yes, we're very grateful. We wouldn't have been able to do the upgrades that we've done without that money.
On Friday 13th November, around 50 pilgrims set out from St Martin in the Fields to travel to Paris to coincide with the UN Climate Conference. We spoke to Bishop Nicholas Holtom about why he is taking part in the pilgrimage.
If you imagine all the conversations taking place behind the pilgrimage in terms of the people who are travelling together, the planning. At our diocesan synod in Salisbury on Saturday, one of the walkers talked about what she was doing. And a group of 120 people at Synod engaged with it, thought about it, prayed about it, were very supportive. Now, I think that's going on all over the country. And that's exciting to see the way in which this has implications beyond its own group. And we're only one pilgrimage. There are cyclists from Copenhagen, seven people walking from the Danish-German border from Flensburg. I walked with them for a day a few weeks ago. 150 people walking with them, gathered in that community. There are people coming from all over, cyclists from South Africa to Nairobi. There are people travelling to support this process because we recognise how important it is and how difficult it is for our politicians and diplomats.
And one of the things I suppose critics might say is that this is an issue for politicians, for diplomats, that this isn't an issue for either the Church of England or for the Pope or for any faith leader to sort of get involved in. You know, what do you think is the importance of the faith dimension, the moral dimension?
Well, it is a big moral issue. I think the poor. So one of the things there's agreement on is that the poor are the people who are carrying the heaviest burden first. I was in Malawi earlier in the year, and the poorest people we met were a group of people planting fruit trees that won't fruit for 3-4 years in order to address issues of soil erosion caused by changing rainfall patterns and changing agriculture. And it's in that area of adaptation and mitigation in relation to climate change. You know, that's Nicholas Stern talking about the impact of this on, you know, 5-20% is what he was estimating in the Stern review. He says he underestimated it in terms of the impact on GDP. Now, if the poorest people get it and are making an investment that isn't going to fruit for them for 3 years, there's a moral imperative on the rest of us. So that's the first thing. The other is, just about everybody involved says this is a spiritual issue. And it's not just religious people saying it's a spiritual issue. The gap between what we say we want and what we do is yawning. And that's a gap that, you know, Christianity actually addresses very explicitly. And therefore, the spirituality of faith is something that we think contributes to the whole conversation about how are we going to get the change to a low-carbon economy.
specifically within that, obviously there's the issue, as you say, of social justice, of the poor, which Christianity speaks to very directly. Is there also a wider issue of the need to protect our planet, not just because you know, it's our home, if we trash it, we don't have anywhere to live, but because, you know, we have been entrusted with God's creation?
Jesus is the summer of the law, love God, love your neighbour as yourself. And this is part of loving your neighbour. So love God, love your neighbour as yourself, and therefore caring for one another in our common home. I think the Pope framed that really well. That's a moral dimension. So is the intergenerational aspect of what are my grandchildren? This is the question David Attenborough asked, isn't it? What will our grandchildren ask of us about us if we do nothing, if we just sail on in the way we are? Ours is the first generation that knows the impact of our actions. And actually, we can't afford to ignore that. And that's the spiritual issues. How do I amend my life? How do I turn my life in such a way as that I do things differently? And that's partly about being more efficient. It's partly reducing use of fossil fuels and beginning that process. And it's a really sort of scientific, intelligent one of how do we develop different technology? How are we going to reduce the carbon footprint of people on Earth such that the climate is not going to be so impacted by our activity?
Do you feel that the interventions from faith groups across the world and sort of as well as the interventions from business and the new technology, do you think that this is all coming together to give a sort of a really strong signal to the politicians and the diplomats in Paris that this time the world is serious about getting a deal?
I hope so. I think people have prepared carefully, thoroughly, well. And under the pressure of negotiations, actually some of the tensions are showing before we even gather. Now, the support of the faith communities really is meant to strengthen the process, to push, to hold people together, to make us realise that we're in this together, to create that sort of solidarity that's going to be needed for us to do this. Not just for me or you, but for the sake of the world.
That's all for this week's podcast. I'm Anna McCrum. Thanks for listening.